Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Ladies and gentlemen from London, England, this program has a lot of kind of serious content today, so let's begin with something so ultimately trivial. In a tribute to one of the classics of early television, let's call it Your Show of So's. Yes, people answering questions, starting with the word so, as if it's a conclusion that they haven't yet even started to reach. Today, our so's come from the BBC, and thanks to a tip from a Le Show listener, from NPR's Science Friday. So sit back, relax, and let this be your Sunday of So's.
Explain how it might be possible to drill through an aquifer containing clean drinking water to get at the shale gas down below and then fracturing the rock down there without causing a release of the methane into the water.
So the reservoirs we're fracturing are several thousands or several thousands of meters deep.
Now, Robin, you've already put some of the practices that Murray has been suggesting into place, and you've seen a massive difference, haven't you?
So we were traditional ram breeders, Suffolk breeders before.
What have you got here?
So this is a New Zealand Suffolk Shearling ram.
Let's go through a couple of your favourites. Give us your favourite.
So the favourites for me are stuff that you build that then gets the kids wet.
Tell us exactly what you found there.
So this is based on a study of 35,000 men.
Well, what is a tsunami on the sun like?
Well, so what happens is you get these huge solar eruptions.
How tall can a tsunami wave be on the sun?
Well, so the tsunamis that we're looking at are generally about 90 million meters above the photosphere.
What can you learn?
Well, so when we see these tsunamis, it generally means that there's a blob of plasma has been fired out into space.
Are these recent discoveries, the tsunamis?
Well, actually, they were first observed in 1997 using a spacecraft called SOHO.
Do you need any more special instruments for this, or what you got? It's pretty good.
So the instrument, the STO spacecraft, is really good.
What's going on there?
Well, so the sun has an 11-year cycle of activity.
What is going on there?
All right, so the research in a nutshell is that prior to several of the explosions during this 20 explosion series that Readout had in 2009, there were these strange harmonic signals.
Some new developments in the initial so this week. They're preceded by well and right. Always something new when it's hello, welcome to the show.
Back up again.
days. Whatever helps to soothe your blue virgin, you know. Enough is never quite enough. Never quite enough. Never quite enough. Never quite enough. People seem happy, so they make you think. We all need comfort, a nameless face, an early morning dream.
From London, England, where the Olympics apparently almost made a profit. We'll get to that later. I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, time to follow the dollar. Well, there seemed... Remember when Enron... The late unlimited Enron manipulated the electricity supplies in California, raising the price of electricity and causing all sorts of problems in the early 2000s. Well, a good idea just refuses to die, even if the company that invented it did. This from the Financial Times. The U.S. electricity markets overseer has slapped Barclays Bank with a record almost $500 million penalty because Barclays manipulated power prices. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's fines matched the amount proposed last year when it accused four former Barclays traders of manipulating physical power prices, electric power prices, in California and other Western states in order to fraudulently boost financial derivative positions. Well, that's a good reason, because it helped make us money. Barclays says they intend to fight the order. Penalty may not be final. If they don't pay penalties within 30 days, the case will be heard again in a federal court that could make its own findings. You may recall Barclays has been also fined $400 million last year for manipulating the benchmark interest rate called LIBOR, putting the lie in LIBOR. FERC, the Federal Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, was a little-known U.S. regulator, but in 2005 it was granted enhanced penalty authority and recently brought cases reflecting that new muscle. In January, it got a $1.5 million fine from Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank over manipulation of the electricity market in the United States. J.P. Morgan Chase has also been warned of a probable FERC enforcement action for manipulating electricity prices in the United States. Chase is in discussions with the regulators about paying what would be a record fine to settle allegations that the bank manipulated electricity markets in both California and the Midwest. The commission and the bank are exchanging drafts of an agreement. See, this is how they do it in the banking world. They don't fine you. You discuss it. You negotiate it. You have drafts of an agreement that will result in J.P. Morgan paying hundreds of millions of dollars. This would be larger than the fine levied against Barclays. The settlement discussions had included a possible fine of close to $1 billion, but the figure has gotten smaller as the talks have progressed. Mr. Police Officer, could we be in talks about the sentence? Many of the biggest U.S. banks and trading firms began buying and selling power in the nation's deregulated energy markets following the California energy crisis of 2001, which was caused by manipulative trading by Enron. See? Can't kill a good thing when it's a bad thing. Follow the dollar. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Do you want to know a secret? Here's one. The National Security Agency has been allowed to extend its dragnet of the telephone records of millions of U.S. customers of Verizon through a court order issued by the secret court that oversees the secret surveillance. That's not a secret. In an unprecedented move, possibly prompted by the fact that all this stuff has become public in the last month, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the Office of the DNI, has publicly revealed that the plan has been extended again. It's extended every 90 days, or has been, for years. The announcement flowed, according to the statement, from the decision to declassify aspects of the metadata search in order to, quote, provide the public with a more thorough and balanced understanding of the program, unquote. The ODNI statement said the administration is undertaking a careful and thorough review of whether and to what extent additional information or documents pertaining to this program may be declassified, consistent with the protection of blah. So, Verizon customers, you're still safe. Thanks to your federal government. Now, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Well, here's something nice. Rupert Murdoch has admitted he was wrong to describe phone hacking and corrupt payments investigations by police into his company and its journalists as incompetent. That's in a letter he sent to the chairman of the Parliamentary Home Affairs Select Committee. The letter marks the first time that Murdoch has spoken about what he's termed a highly emotional meeting that occurred in March with journalists at his tabloid newspaper in London, The Sun, who had been arrested and who faced trial for allegedly paying public officials for information. That meeting, as you may know, was secretly recorded. The tape of it was subsequently leaked. Speaking to his staff, who were working for The Sun, Murdoch had said at the meeting, "Here we are 2 years later, and the cops are totally incompetent." Unquote. Murdoch. At the time, he does now say in his letter to the parliamentary chairman, "I have no basis to question the competence of the police. Whilst I regret my choice of words in that highly emotional meeting, I care deeply about our employees, and I was and am troubled by the effect of these events on them." Unquote. He cares deeply about his employees. That is so nice to know. I feel warm all over. News of Nice Corp. Nice people. Doing nice things. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news. This is just something to keep in mind as you follow the story of Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, and his attempts to find asylum somewhere outside the United States. From the Guardian newspaper in London, former CIA Milan station chief Robert Selden Lady, who was convicted in Italy of kidnapping an Egyptian Muslim cleric and was recently arrested in Panama, is headed back to the United States, according to a State Department spokeswoman. She said she had no further details on whether he would be questioned by U.S. authorities or whether the United States would cooperate with Italy on this case. Italy's top court last year upheld a guilty verdict against Lady, Robert Selden Lady, for the kidnapping of Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasser. So nice, they named him four times, who was snatched from a Milan street in 2003 and flown to Egypt for interrogation, where he apparently was tortured. Selden Lady was among 23 Americans sentenced in absentia for the abduction of the cleric by an Italian judge in 2009. He was given a 9-year jail term. He was quoted as telling a newspaper in Italy in 2009 he was following orders from his superiors. The CIA declined comment, and this week the former high official in the Italian intelligence agency was given a 10-year sentence by an Italian judge for his role in the extraordinary rendition caper. But Panama, which arrested Selden Lady this week and was supposedly holding him for Interpol, had its move apparently checkmated by the United States, which is bringing Mr. Selden Lady back to our shores. Just a little bit of contrast for the Edward Snowden story, don't you think? I do. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, on stage, Mr. Adam.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
Our friend, the Adam.
You call me Mister.
I did. From the Ethel Merman show?
No.
Tokyo Electric Power Company said radioactive cesium levels in a well at the Fuk No. 1 nuclear power plant last week were 90 times higher than those measured at the same site just 3 days earlier.
It's a cesium surge.
That's right. It's the only surge General Petraeus isn't responsible for. TEPCO said the next day, cesium levels of 27,000 becquerels per liter, the highest cesium levels found since the disaster, were detected in water samples a day earlier from a well on the seaward side of the number 2 reactor building. It's unclear whether the radioactive water is leaking into the sea, said a TEPCO official. We'll conduct analyses. The unusually high cesium levels were found in a well near the water intake for the number 2 reactor, from which highly radioactive water leaked into the sea a couple years ago. That's 150 times the legally permitted level, and 18,000 becquerels of cesium-137, 200 times the legally allowed level, were also detected in the water. Levels of other radioactive substances, including strontium, were the same as days earlier. We do not know why only cesium levels have risen, said a TEPCO official.
Cesium? I hardly knew him.
Thank you. Several nuclear power plants around the world still do not have adequate contingency plans in place for severe accidents more than 2 years after Fuk, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the Vienna-based watchdog, don't feed the dog, did not spell out in its annual nuclear safety review which power plants it had found lacking. Ooh, that's tough. And an IAEA spokesman this week could not provide such details. At one power plant inspected under IAEA auspices, a severe accident plan is to be implemented only next year. And in a second one, there were guidelines, but staff were not trained to use them. In other power plants, programs did not address the occurrence of accidents at several units simultaneously, according to the agency.
Well, that'll never happen. Not possible.
That's correct. Dateline Monticello, Minnesota, a major upgrade to Minnesota's oldest nuclear power plant is finally finished and way over budget. Xcel Energy expects to start its Monticello nuclear power plant this week after a four-month shutdown that allowed workers to replace aging pumps and other equipment to keep the 43-year-old reactor running. The cost of the work surged.
Here's another non-Petraeus surge.
There you go. By $267 million, or 83% over its original 2008 budget. And guess who's going to pay? Ratepayers. No, it's only fair. Such cost overruns are further proof of the, quote, very dicey, unquote, economics of nuclear power, says Mark Cooper, a senior research fellow for economic analysis at Vermont Law School's Institute for Energy and the Environment. Quote, they cannot build these things or repair them or expand them without having severe cost overruns, and that is part of the technology, he says. Utility officials declined to answer questions about the cost overruns, saying it would be inappropriate to comment while state regulators are considering the requests for a rate hike. Yeah. You notice businesses never make public statements while their cases are before regulators. Never happen. Panels of alarms designed to quickly warn personnel of operational failures at the Pilgrim nuclear power station mysteriously shut down this week, just as mysteriously restarted 2 hours later.
No alarm.
No alarm. They shut down. The system failure required Entergy, the owner and operator of the Pilgrim plant, to report an unusual event to the NRC, which is now trying to determine the cause of the failure. Meanwhile, the plant is operating at full power, because why not? Dateline Geneva, scientists have discovered a radioactive substance in sediment under a Swiss lake used for drinking water and situated near a nuclear plant, according to a Swiss newspaper. While scientists cited in the report stressed there was no danger to human health.
Ever.
The discovery raises concerns about safety practices and a lack of transparency at the Mühlenberg nuclear plant in northwestern Switzerland. The plant is believed to have caused a spike in cesium-137.
Cesium? I hardly knew it.
Found in the sediment of Lake Beale and dating back to 2000 through the discharge of contaminated wastewater into the river that feeds the lake. Estimated radiation doses in thyroid glands exceeded safe levels in nearly 2,000 people who worked at the stricken Fuk nuclear plant, more than 10 times the number previously announced, according to the Asahi Shimbun newspaper. The larger figure was deduced after doubts were raised both in Japan and abroad over the results of TEPCO's belated first study on the workers' health. TEPCO had said back in December, radiation doses topped the widely accepted threshold for an increase in the risk of cancer in 178 people, but that figure covered only a fraction of those who have braved the high radiation levels to try to bring the crisis under control. The workers themselves say TEPCO has provided little or no information about radiation doses in their thyroid glands. Some have stopped working at the crippled plant.
Why is an electric utility supposed to know about your thyroid gland?
It's a good question. TEPCO and its partner companies not only reevaluated the readings from thyroid gland dose tests, they also estimated doses when the amount of radioactive iodine at the end of the body was unavailable. And so doses topped the benchmark 100 millisievert mark in almost 2,000 workers. In one worker, the estimated thyroid gland dose increased by more than 1,000 millisieverts during the review. Early in the crisis, health experts warned about the risks of high radiation doses received by the workers. TEPCO was late in opening a full-scale investigation into the thyroid gland doses.
Better late than later.
Mm-hmm. The ongoing heat wave could force Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station to shut down. That's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, as soaring temperatures continue to warm the Cape Cod Bay waters that the plant relies on to cool key safety systems. Just to review, the water is getting too hot to cool the plant that's needed to split atoms to boil water. Why don't they just wait till the nearby bay waters are warm enough to boil? Then you can produce steam and you don't need the thing. Pilgrim's license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission requires the water being drawn from the bay to be no warmer than 75 degrees, but it's warmer than that now. If water temperatures rise and show no sign of lowering, the plant has 24 hours to completely shut down. This is not a problem limited only to this area, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. Millstone Unit 2 nuclear power plant in Connecticut was forced to shut down for several days last summer, as reported on this broadcast, when ocean water from Long Island Sound became too warm. The limit at that plant, too, is 75 degrees, although the plant operators have asked that the cooling water limit be raised to 80 degrees.
Less cooling.
Less cooling, more TARs. And that is news of our friend the Atom.
Thank you. I'm released.
You are released, but there are related stories in News of the Warm. Won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Which brings us news of water and power, though not nuclear power. A new study released this week finds that so much water may be lost in the Volta River Basin in Africa due to climate change, that planned hydroelectric projects to boost energy and food production may only tread water in keeping up with actual demand. Some 24 million people in Ghana, Burkina Faso, and four other neighboring countries depend on the Volta River and their tributaries as their principal source of water. The researchers concluded the combined effects of higher temperatures and diminished rain could mean that by the year 2100, all of the current and planned hydro projects in the basin would not even generate as much power as existing facilities do now. Meanwhile, there would only be enough water to meet about a third of immigration demand. And the Union of Concerned Scientists says that although 2012 was a year of severe drought in the United States, the problems seen at various coal, nuclear, and hydropower facilities last summer are only likely to increase in coming years unless the power sector quickly changes its way of doing business. Power generation in the United States relies heavily on water for some plants. like the ones that run on coal or nuclear. The water is needed for cooling. Hydro directly uses water for energy production. More than 40% of fresh water used in the United States is withdrawn to cool power plants. Renewable energy generally uses less water, except for geothermal and concentrating solar. The report from the Union of Concerned Scientists says that even though the oldest and most water-hungry coal-fired power plants are being retired, the shift to cleaner energy isn't happening fast enough to overcome increasing water shortages. We set electricity and water on a collision course years ago, says the chair of the Scientific Advisory Committee of the Union. Now we must build a power system hardwired not for risk but for resilience, he says. Coal use will drop significantly through 2050. The change will not significantly reduce the power sector's carbon emissions because demand will rise and natural gas will replace coal. Natural gas plants use less water than coal or nuclear, except for the ones that are based on natural gas derived from fracking. Hydrofracking requires far more water than conventional drilling. Also, even though some newer plants might use far less water, they could find there's far less water available as water temperatures go up and water flows go down. Nearly half of 423 U.S. electric plants were at risk of lower power output during droughts because their intake pipes for water are less than 3 meters below the surface. And during a drought, the surface may get lower than that. Water and power. News of the Warm, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Turning atoms.
from London, this is Le Show. And now...
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the special inspector general for Afghanistan reconstruction, talking about one aspect of Afghan reconstruction. This is courtesy of our friends at C-SPAN.
In late 2009, early 2010, the Army put a request in to build a command structure at Camp Leatherneck in southern Afghanistan. Within months, a decision was made that the Army wasn't going to be in Camp Leatherneck. The Marines were going to be there. The Marine general took a look at the plans, said, I don't want it. I don't need it. I won't use it. Stop it. So he said that in May of 2010. And then the process just continues, and that's what we find out. Once you appropriate money, it gets spent. So even though he didn't want it as early as 2010, they let the contract in 2011, and they started building it. And what we eventually have now, it was turned over to the military commander now, a building that's almost totally complete, costs $35 million, and nobody wants it. The commander didn't need it. The Marine Corps commander had his own headquarters, didn't want it. It's a rather luxurious Taj Mahal, and he didn't want it. So before the first shovel went into the ground, the Marine Corps commander who was running the mission down there said, I don't want it. Don't build it. We're going to try to find out who the individual was who ignored the Marine Corps general and continued with the construction. Its original purpose, as far as we can tell, was going to be a command headquarters for a Army division. It's the best constructed building I have seen in Afghanistan. We find a lot of buildings that are falling down, buildings that will electrocute students, buildings where the roofs fall down. We just announced two alert letters. We usually find a lot of shoddy construction, horrible construction. Actually, on that base right now, we're looking at some other sites of poor construction. But this one was perfect. I mean, almost perfect. The irony is that just a few months ago, the DOD IG went in, different team, took a look at their fire escapes and fire suppression system and recommended they improve them. And the military, even though this building will probably be torn down, spent taxpayers' dollars to improve the fire suppression system on a building that will probably be destroyed. With the drawdown in Leatherneck, which is the base where it's located, this building will be on the other side of the fence. This building will no longer be in Camp Leatherneck. As we draw down our soldiers there, the base is going to get smaller, shrinking. This building will be left on the other side. So it's a security risk for U.S. to use it. The three options, and they're all bad. One is just to tear it down because the military doesn't need it. And it costs money to keep it going. I mean, its heating and air conditioning is going constantly right now, and there's nobody in it. The other option is to turn it over to the Afghans. Well, that may be good, but no one's talked to the Afghans, and that's one of the problems we see throughout. We don't talk to the Afghans. We don't know if they want it or need it. So, and then the big problem with that is this was built to U.S. standards, and the Afghans may not be able to maintain it or sustain it. We got some information that came to us that even the U.S. military may have problems maintaining this because you need some special technical capabilities that they don't have on the base anymore. The third option is they actually were thinking of turning the war room, which was supposed to be a classified room in which they do planning for the war, they were going to turn the war room into a theater for movies. So maybe they'd be showing Catch-22, which I think would be an appropriate movie there, or maybe Dr. Strangelove, but that was the idea. We'll turn it into a war room and then a rec room down in the bottom. Now, a 64,000 square foot rec room and theater. And then it turns out there are not enough Marines, not enough U.S. personnel there to actually move into the base and use it for that. So that probably is not the option. In all likelihood, the building's going to be ripped down. There have been a lot of reports written about lessons learned in Iraq. As a senior general told me, the problem is that nobody actually applies any of the lessons learned. And so what we saw in Iraq has just been repeated in Afghanistan. And what our concern is that this will be repeated again if we go into another country and have another situation like this. The dirty little secret on this case, and this is the reason why we focused on what we call the 64K building, the 64,000 square foot building, is a number of generals came up to me the last time I was in Afghanistan and said, please look at this. This is indicative of the problem of military construction. Once it starts, it never stops. So that's why we highlighted it. And so we're going to find out who's responsible here.
That's the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, positing the possible accountability. But wait, there's more. From our friends at the United States Army Corps of Engineers, a $3.4 million teacher's school in northern Afghanistan remains unfinished and dangerous to its occupants 4 years after construction began. The contractor faced no penalties for failing to complete the project. That's, again, according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. More than 4 years after construction began, the Sherburgan Teacher Training Facility remains incomplete. Its history is one of broken promises and undelivered results, says the report. In February 2009, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers awarded an Iraqi contractor, Mercury Development, an almost $3 million contract to build the teacher training facility. It was supposed to have been completed in January 2010. Deadline later extended to June 2011, a year and a half later. Contract raised to $3.5 million, but the contractor abandoned the project in late 2011 before construction was complete and before they resolved health and safety concerns. Mercury Development was paid most of the value of the contract. The Army Corps of Engineers show in their files that the contractor completed the project, despite ample evidence to the contrary. The Corps also released Mercury from any further liability for deficiencies with the project. 4 years after construction began, sewage, water, and electrical systems are unfinished. The electrical systems exposed users of the facility to the risk of electrocution, and a well for drinking water was placed too close to a sewer line. Quote, this raises concerns because we have previously reported instances in which the Corps failed to hold its contractors accountable for accomplishing the work they were paid to perform, according to the Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. They, the Special Inspector General's office, believes that the Corps of Engineers must take immediate action to hold contractors accountable when they fail to deliver on their commitments. Good luck with that, too. Just let them try. And an escalating dispute between the Afghan government and the United States over customs procedures has halted the flow of U.S. military equipment across Afghanistan's borders, forcing commanders to rely more heavily on air transport, dramatically increasing the cost of the drawdown of U.S. stuff. The Afghan government is demanding the U.S. military pay $1,000, as according to the Washington Post, for each shipping container leaving Afghanistan that doesn't have a corresponding validated customs form. Huh. The country's customs agency says the American military has racked up $70 million in fines so far. If unresolved, the disagreement could inflate the price tag of the U.S. military withdrawal by hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, because of the higher cost of shipping by air. That's an unwelcome expenditure at a time when the Pentagon is scrambling to cope with budget cuts. The Afghan government's demand for payment is part of a broader dispute over Kabul's authority to tax United States entities. The United States having been its chief benefactor for over a decade, as the war economy that for years bankrolled Afghanistan's elite starts to deflate, the government is increasingly insisting that the U.S. defense contractors pay business taxes and fines for a range of alleged violations. This latest fight has added a new irritant to negotiations over that bilateral security agreement that would decide whether any U.S. troops stay in Afghanistan after 2014. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction warns Congress that Afghan ministries are seeking to collect nearly $1 billion in business taxes and fines from U.S. contractors, an effort that American officials, at least some of them, see as a massive shakedown in one of the world's most corrupt countries. U.S. funds intended to rebuild Afghanistan, says Inspector General John Sopko, are increasingly being used to, quote, pay the cost of doing business in Afghanistan. Of course, there's another way to get the stuff out of there.
The Army says it's all gotta go. The Afghans say it can't leave. And I say, saving bucks starts here. Hi, I'm B-Rock, with the greatest money-saving deals since the Indians sold Manhattan. Ever wanted to own a partially armored Humvee of your very own? And ever wondered how you could do it without paying Pentagon prices? The answer is as close as B-Rock's Afghan Closeout Blowout. And not just vehicles. This event is putting on sale for the first time and for the last time until the next time. The biggest sale of military and outdoor gear since Custer said uncle. How about your own war room? Thousands of square feet for you to strategize your next big move, or just to watch the big game in hyper-secure comfort. The price? Too low to mention on the air. Too low to mention even on an encrypted phone line. But time's running short, and we've got to move an entire war's worth of gear. Our loss is your gain. Although, since we're you, it's your loss, too. It's all here waiting for you. State-of-the-art communications equipment, barracks-grade cooking supplies, enough uniforms to supply an invading force of your own, anti-insurgent spray, Afghan-English e-dictionaries. All you do is charge it, and then you pick it up and pocket the savings. Now, if the U.S. government transported this stuff back home, it might cost double or triple what you'll pay at B-Rock's Afghan Closeout Blowout. And your credit? We've already got your credit report on our health insurance computer, so you're ready to rock and roll. The B-Rock way. But don't take my word for it. Listen to this general who works for me.
Whether you're looking for camo or ammo, fixed wing or rotor, the only thing better than our guarantee would be a certificate of victory. Heck, I'd love to buy some of this gear for myself, but the Afghans won't let me. They're crazy.
And you don't have to go to some showroom or warehouse. It's all online at BRock.gov. Every night scope, every canteen, every up-armored bribe bag. The ones Army scientists developed for paying off warlords. It's like a strong box in a sack. And they're not just at rock-bottom prices. They're at B-Rock-bottom prices. But these savings won't last forever. Eventually, the sun's gonna die. So log on, click through, and agree to the terms of use without reading them. B-Rock's Afghan Closeout Blowout. The best way to wind down a weekend and a war.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Leanne McDougall, a film writer who specializes in genre movies and has been linked romantically to Quentin Tarantino, has been accused of repeated plagiarism and apparently has taken to Twitter to apologize for lifting whole sections of other articles. Quote, "I apologize for the plagiarism in my work. I'm leaving journalism behind for a while. I'm so very sorry, especially those I've wronged," unquote. Her Twitter account appears to have been suspended or closed. We get to a, speaking of Twitter, a big file of apologies this week. Football players apologizing for their tweets. Pittsburgh Steelers Pro Bowl center Marquise Pouncey took to Twitter this week to apologize for wearing a red Free Hernandez hat alongside his twin brother during their birthday bash at a Florida nightclub. The photo circulated around the internet last week. The Pouncey brothers were teammates of former Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez at Florida. Hernandez, you may know, is charged with first-degree murder. "I fully recognize the seriousness of the situation involving my former teammate," Pouncey wrote, "and I regret that my actions appear to make light of that serious situation. I apologize to anyone who is offended by my actions," unquote. And New York Giants star wide receiver Victor Cruz was one of many athletes to take to Twitter following the verdict in the George Zimmerman trial. Like most of the others, he felt some post-tweet regret. Like Atlanta Falcons wide receiver Roddy White, Cruz has apologized for his tweet that stated Zimmerman wouldn't last a year before, quote, "the hood caught up with him." The apology? "My tweet last night was my initial interpretation of the reaction. I was reading on Twitter. I immediately realized my tweet was a mistake, and I apologized. That's why I deleted it. I believe conversation and not confrontation leads to change and progress." That sounds like a football player. In the last year, Canada has seen mayors slapped with corruption accusations and gangsterism charges, one linked to a crack-smoking video. Now one says he kills kittens. The mayor of Huntington, Quebec, Stéphane Gendron, has been forced to apologize for joking about he enthusiastically kills cats with his car, even newborns. The small-town mayor, whose other career is Radio Shock Jock, posted a letter on the website of his show explaining that his dark humor had done nothing to raise the level of debate over animal control. "When I see a cat in the street, I accelerate," he had said days earlier on his radio show. "Stray cats have no business on the street," he said. I accelerate. "The other day I backed up over a newborn, and I'm sure it didn't feel a thing." One of his fellow hosts called his comments sick. Gendron's statement of apology came after the SPCA said it had opened an investigation into the mayor. Speaking of Canada, popular Canadian donut chain, which I think has a branch or two in New York City, Tim Hortons has apologized for blocking a gay and lesbian website, a news website, from its in-store Wi-Fi networks. The chain was facing an online backlash after it was revealed it restricted customers from accessing DailyExtra.com, the online home for the free newspaper Extra that's distributed in Canada. When the publication asked that the site be unblocked, assuming it was an error, it received an email stating the site was, quote, not appropriate for all ages viewing in a public environment. We try to ensure that all of our guests can enjoy a safe and pleasant experience when visiting us. Reads an email from the address Tim Hortons Wi-Fi at timhortons.com. While there is no way to change this decision, we can assure you it was not an easy decision to make. Unquote. Then, a few hours after Twitter users began promising to boycott Hortons, spokeswoman Michelle Robichaud apologized on behalf of the company and blamed a third-party service provider for the error and resulting miscommunication. And that Falcons wide receiver Roddy White called for the jurors in the Zimmerman trial case to kill themselves. He then tweeted about folks wanting him to get in trouble, and later he apologized. I understand my tweet last night was extreme. I never meant for the people to do that. I was shocked and upset about the verdict. I am sorry, said Falcon wide receiver White. Dateline Bangkok, Thailand's premier university has apologized for displaying a billboard that showed Adolf Hitler alongside Superman and other superheroes, saying it was painted by ignorant students who didn't realize Hitler's image would offend anyone. That's some ignorance. The huge billboard was placed outside the art faculty of Chulalongkorn University. Sorry. As part of a tribute to this year's graduating class, it said congratulations in bold white letters and showed Hitler with his arm raised in a Nazi salute next to Batman, Captain America, the Incredible Hulk, and Iron Man. They're all super, aren't they? Quote, we would like to formally express our sincere apology for our students' superhero mural, said the art school dean, whose name I will not mispronounce. I can assure you we are taking this matter very seriously. Dateline Port Angeles, Washington, an army official traveled 80 miles to an Olympic Peninsula city to apologize in person this week for a recent nighttime training exercise that the Port Angeles mayor says terrorized her city with low-flying helicopters. The army didn't do the public notification that we normally do, said Colonel Charles Hodges Jr. Again, I apologize for that particular fact. Speaking of airborne apologies, Buenos Aires Dateline. Authorities of Italy and Portugal apologized for the incident involving Bolivia's presidential aircraft grounded in Europe earlier this month, according to Bolivia's foreign minister in Buenos Aires. The aircraft had been in the air over 3 hours after taking off from Moscow when France, Spain, Portugal, and some other European countries announced the closure of their airspace to it. France and Spain already apologized to Bolivia for closing its airspace, and Spain apologized this week for its part in the events that led to the plane being delayed. We recognize publicly that perhaps the procedures used in the Vienna airport by our representative were not the most effective, said Spain's ambassador to Bolivia. We regret this fact. The procedure was not appropriate. Dateline London, right here in London town. Britain's top policeman has apologized for using the names of dead children to help establish false identities for undercover work. 42 dead children had been used. Their names had been used by police. Metropolitan Police Chief Bernard Hogan Howe says he is sorry for the shock and offense the tactic caused. The families of the children whose names were used have not been told because that would put undercover agents at risk. And this program did not exist. J.K. Rowling's initial regret at the revelation of her secret identity as a critically acclaimed debut crime novelist has now turned into anger. It was her lawyers who did it. A partner at their law firm was the cause of the disclosure. He told his wife's best friend who the author really was. We, Russell's solicitors, apologize unreservedly for the disclosure caused by one of our partners in revealing to his wife's best friend during a private conversation the true identity was, in fact, J.K. Rowling. Whilst accepting his own culpability, the disclosure was made in confidence to someone he trusted implicitly. We can only confirm this leak was not part of any marketing plan and that neither J.K. Rowling, her agent, or publishers were in any way involved. And Keith Olbermann is back on television at ESPN. He sounded contrite about his previous behavior. He had gotten fired from ESPN years earlier. "We can gather everybody who took offense at what I did, and we need Yankee Stadium," he said. "I can say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I mentioned the Olympics. The British government, having spent the best part of about $15 billion on putting on the Olympics last year, came out with a first anniversary report that says about $14.5 billion came from the Olympics to boost the British economy. Says a BBC analyst, "We should be cautious with this figure. It's impossible to know how much of the money can be attributed directly to the Olympics. Much of it may have happened anyway. Sports participation since 2005 is up by $1.4 billion, as the government bragged. But in the last year, since the Olympics, it's actually dropped by 200,000. And there is, ladies and gentlemen, despite the government's claims of contracts made and people employed because of the Olympics, there is the uncomfortable fact, as reported on this program a year ago, that if you went into actual London, actual central London during the Olympics, businesses, theaters, restaurants that were expecting a bonanza were empty because everybody was out way east of here at the Olympic site, where they were trapped in a giant mall if they tried to leave the Olympic stadium or the Olympic facilities. A similar thing happened in New Orleans, by the way, during the Super Bowl this year. Businesses that were not within a block or two of the Super Bowl, except for hotels, of course, did not experience a bonanza. Maybe a few restaurants did. But at least as far as the Olympics effect on central London last year, that area resembled nothing so much as central London on those few days each year when it snows.
Empty like a politician's words. Avenues bereft except for buses, vans and birds. Elbows barely needed when you walk through Leicester Square. Central London's quiet 'cause there's no them there. Like the wintry silence when commuters day away. It's a faux snow day. It's a faux snow day. Walking to cafe or shop, you're greeted like a prince. A mob's what they were promised, they haven't seen one since. Cabbies love to grumble, now they've got a reason why. Central London simmers underneath the fickle sky. Like the ballet daytimes when the parks are just for play. It's a faux snow day. Road signs on the highway ask you please to stay away. Mayor Boris Johnson says you'd be a fool to stay. Games lanes are unoccupied, empty seats galore. This would be a great event to locate on a moor. February looks like this, but not July or May. It's a faux snow day. Just a faux snow day. 60 zillion visitors are here to see a show. Paid for by the taxes of the people down below. Is there a bonanza here that just cannot be seen? Or has the town been run round through the scam machine? Snow jobs cover everything, especially feet of clay. On a faux snow day. On a faux snow day.
News of the warm, briefly, a satellite that measures gravity fluctuations on Earth due to changes in the massive ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica has detected a rapid acceleration in the melting of glacier ice over the past decade, which could have a dramatic impact on sea levels around the world. The sheets are losing around 300 billion tons of ice a year, according to this research. Scientists have warned that the measurements gathered since 2002 by the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment flying in space are still too short-term for accurate predictions of how much ice will be lost in the coming decades, and therefore how rapidly sea levels will rise. And the head of a key Senate subcommittee is questioning the reliability of part of the U.S. missile defense system after a failed test earlier this month. We reported upon that. It failed. A preliminary review of the test traced the problem to something called the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle, the portion of the missile that separates from the main body to intercept or knock an incoming projectile out of the sky. The kill vehicle did not separate from the third stage booster. It wasn't the booster. It wasn't the guidance system. So it was the kill part that didn't work. The Defense Department remains confident in the Boeing-made system, even though it's actually never taken out an intercontinental ballistic missile. What's important is continued testing, said the spokesman for the Pentagon, and the continued buying. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.49 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and KCSN.org, available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast from iTunes and Sideshow Network. And it'd be just like accountability if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and a playlist of the music heard here on and a fabulous store, all available at harryshearer.com. And you can find me on Twitter, not apologizing, at the Harry Shearer. Not apologizing yet. So glad to find out that Rupert Murdoch can be highly emotional. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network.